I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama has been out stumping for his jobs program. And yesterday, House Speaker John Boehner threw some cold water on it. The fallout from Monday's GOP presidential debate has reverberated throughout the week. Also this week, a Republican won a New York congressional seat that had been held by Democrats for decades. Up in Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren announced her bid for the U.S. Senate, which could give Republican Scott Brown a run for his money. Meanwhile, here in Pennsylvania, Republicans are talking about changing the winner-take-all electoral system to one that apportions electoral votes by congressional district. Now, that sounds pretty wonky, but it could affect the outcome of the 2012 presidential race. Well, here to talk about all of this and more is Steve Kornacki. He's political editor for Salon. And Steve, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Happy to do it.
Robert Costa is also with us as well. He's the National Review's political reporter, I guess, born and raised in Bucks County. And Robert Costa, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, great to be here, a longtime listener.
Well, we're happy to have you. Let me get even wonkier and even go back to this has to do with Pennsylvania. Go back to 2008. Obama got 55% of the vote. McCain got about 44% of the vote. Obama got 21 electoral votes. Under this new system, with those same numbers, Obama would have gotten 11 and McCain would have gotten 10. I guess I'll put this to you, Robert Costa. Are the Republicans in Pennsylvania doing smart politics?
I think they are doing smart politics for 2012. After Pat Toomey's win in 2010, I think they're very optimistic about their chances next year. But I think it could backfire in numerous ways because Pennsylvania, as we all know, is a swing state. And sometimes if Philadelphia's turnout is so high and the GOP struggles to generate enthusiasm throughout the rest of the state, it really could backfire. And sometimes Pennsylvania can be won for Republicans in the current system by generating turnout in the center of the state, even if Philadelphia is relatively strong. So it may be a short-term good decision for the GOP, especially since the president is weak. But I think sometimes Republicans are maybe a little too clever in trying to carve things up and not thinking about the long-term consequences.
Steve, how do you see this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's gotten a lot of attention, and I think that's understandable. I think it's caused a lot of concern among Democrats who look at the math that you just described from 2008. They think about 2012, and they get understandably nervous. But I think this thing is going absolutely nowhere, and I think that's because there's a recognition even within the Republican Party in Pennsylvania, within a number of forces in the Republican Party, I should say, that this isn't smart. One of the reasons is, you know, just that. You look at 2010, and you see there is a chance in the right year that Republicans can win the entire state. And you look at the economy right now, and you look at how the 2012 race is shaping up. And, you know, I know Republicans haven't won Pennsylvania at the presidential level since 1988. But at least right now, you'd look ahead and you'd say they'll have a reasonable chance of carrying it in 2012. So if you have a plan like this, suddenly you're looking at, you know, instead of winning all 20 electoral votes in 2012, potentially, Republicans could actually be costing themselves electoral votes with this. The other factor, I think, though, is there's resistance among some of the Republican congressmen closer to the Philadelphia area who feel this would make Democrats, a plan like this would make Democrats focus much more intently on you know, spending and driving up turnout in their districts and hurting them. So I think you're seeing Republicans even speaking out publicly and probably a lot more privately against this. I think for Republicans to pull something like this off, there has to be total unanimity within the party that's not there.
And Robert, that gets us to these suburban counties that ring Pennsylvania that have been Republican, they have been Democrat, and perhaps focuses the presidential race in these counties.
Very much so. You see that President Obama did well in places like Bucks County, Montgomery County last time. And one of the reasons that Republicans are trying to move towards this new electoral map and rewarding votes in this fashion is that in the state legislature, they have the ability to redraw the map this cycle. And so they're confident that in districts like the 8th, the 10th, around the Philadelphia area, they can have better districts next time around. Yet, Steve makes a good point that these are always bellwether districts every presidential year. Pennsylvania 8, Mike Fitzpatrick, Charlie Dent, Alison Schwartz even to a degree. And Pennsylvania Republicans have to be careful that they've oftentimes survived, and people like Mike Fitzpatrick are reelected in Bucks County, because even though presidential campaigns focus on Bucks County, they're not always the key, because when you're playing statewide, Democrats so often with Bob Rady in Philadelphia are placing emphasis on turnout there. But if it comes down to districts, someone like Mike Fitzpatrick, who's in a swing district, and Charlie Dent, who's oftentimes won by small margins, Jim Gerlach the same way in the Philadelphia region, you're going to see them have real candidates run against them, especially in presidential cycles like 2012, because national money will come in. And so often in swing districts around Philadelphia, it's hard to field a candidate in a presidential year because the money's going elsewhere in the state. But if the money's coordinated in this new system, you could have some real trouble for Republicans in swing areas.
And back to you, Steve, just a reminder that states get to decide how they want to apportion these electoral college votes. And I believe two states, just Nebraska and Maine, have this winner-take-all, and have this apportion vote, and everyone else is winner-take-all.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's a reason why it's only Maine and it's only Nebraska that have done this, and it really hasn't spread elsewhere. And, you know, when you look at Maine and Nebraska, I know we have the example from 2008 where Obama was able to win, you know, one of the districts in Nebraska and get an extra electoral vote. That's the only time that that's ever happened in either one of those states. But when you look at, you know, the bigger states, I think you have two different dynamics that keep this sort of thing from happening. One is you take a state like, say, Texas, which is pretty strongly Republican state. So there's, you know, run by Republicans and it has a ton of electoral votes and a ton of districts, but you're not going to see a movement by Republicans there to break it up by district because they assume they're going to win the electoral votes. And then you look at a state like Pennsylvania or maybe, say, even Michigan, where there I know that Republicans control the governorship and control the legislature and could theoretically do this. Then you're in a swing state. Then you're in an environment where if you do this and you take an awful lot of heat for it, you know, if this is something that the Democrats make just an issue out of, the Republicans are changing the rules and you know, to try to help, you know, their presidential candidate, there's serious consequences potentially within the state, within politics, you know, in the state, for a Republican Party that would do that, or for that matter, for a Democratic Party that would do it in another state. So I think there's a reason why it hasn't happened elsewhere, and again, I think there's a reason why it won't end up happening in Pennsylvania.
And Robert Costa, speaking of rules, it seems that the Republican Party knows how to use our political system better than the Democratic Party. I'm thinking of whatever the Republicans may decide in Pennsylvania, and I hear you both say that there could be unintended consequences, but I'm also thinking about how the Republicans have been able to use the Senate rules to their advantage. Do you think the GOP understands the political system and is willing to use it to their own advantage more than the Democrats?
I think that's kind of a broad question, but I think you're making a good point in the sense that when it comes at least to redrawing districts, Republicans, I think, are smarter and more strategic, at least this year. For instance, Republicans last year had Ed Gillespie, the former head of the party, former RNC chair, running a group called the Republican State Committee, which ran state races across the country, made sure that Republicans were organized in state races, not just congressional races and gubernatorial races last year. And by winning so many state legislatures last year, they enabled themselves this year to be able to redraw the map, to come up with plans like Governor Corbett's, because they control the majorities in the states. And that's real power politics. That's really where decisions are made at the state level and who's drawing districts in the back rooms. And I think in that sense, Republicans maybe this time are better oriented towards the rules and winning campaigns. But I think Republicans do lag behind on some of the new rules, per se, of politics, about social networking, about connecting with voters. I think Democrats are perhaps ahead in that way. But in the old school part of gerrymandering and redistricting, Republicans are pretty sharp. And I think the Senate rules, though, your point there, I think it's a wash. I think both sides have strategists on the legislative side that are pretty smart, and I wouldn't say that Republicans have an advantage in any sense.
What do you think, Steve?
You know, I think there are a couple different issues there. I mean, I think you have to look at what the governing priorities for both parties are when they attain power. And I think there is a point to be made that Republicans, whether it's at state levels, you talk about this proposal in Pennsylvania, you think about the public union plan that was pushed through in Wisconsin, which, you know, I think one of the aims there, I know there's a financial aspect to it, but I think it's fair to say that one of the aims there on the part of some of the Republicans who were backing it was to really kind of take power away from a strong Democratic constituency, from a strong force, strong political force on the Democratic side of the public unions and unions in general. So I think there is something to be said for Republicans making it more one of their governing priorities to use the power that they have to sort of enhance their own political power and their own prospects in elections. But I think it's also fair to say that we've seen this kind of talk, this kind of maneuvering before on the Democratic side. I can think back to Colorado in the 2004 presidential cycle. Some Democrats actually put a referendum on the ballot out there, would have apportioned the electoral votes in Colorado by district, and the thought was, you know, it had gone Republican in 2000. They looked at the 2000 election. They said, if we had done it by district, Al Gore would be president because he would have picked up four more electoral votes in Colorado, and that would have put him over the top. Some Democrats put that on the ballot in Colorado in 2004. And then, you know, about 2 months before the election, they realized they had a chance to carry the state, and so they encouraged everybody to vote against it. So they wanted all nine electoral votes.
Gets tricky.
But Democrats have tried this kind of thing before, too. That's also fair to say.
And Robert Costa, just shifting gears and speaking more broadly and just talking about the sort of tenor of our politics, even beyond electoral politics, it seems that we are in a very intense period. Would you agree with that, Robert?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I've really never seen it like this here in Capitol Hill, where I'm calling you from. It's very tense, very partisan, and I think it's only going to get more intense as the presidential cycle heats up. I've been on the campaign trail a lot, and I think there's some underwhelming reporting going on about the Republican primary. Conservatives are still struggling to find out who their candidate's going to be. But in terms of the battle between right and left, Obama versus the Republicans, it's very heated. The activists on the right are very angry. Independent voters seem to be very sour about the president and the economy, and I think it's only going to get more intense because these are big issues. These are big times. In 1996, when Bob Dole was running against Clinton, there was a lot of jokes that everything's become trivial, and same thing in 1988, Dukakis-Bush, was called the Trivial Pursuit. This year, it doesn't seem like that at all. It's intense, it's real, and it's going to be a fascinating campaign to watch.
Steve, we're about a minute away from our first break here, but do you think, and we should say the election is more than a year away, but do you think the president is in trouble with his own party?
With his own party, no, I don't think so. I mean, to the extent that you see, you know, polling data and you see signs that his support is slipping, you know, within the Democratic Party with, you know, self-identified liberals or what have you, I think that's just a reflection of his support is slipping everywhere. And I think there are some other sort of critical, you know, demographic groups that he slipped even more significantly, you know, among than groups in the Democratic Party. I think it's not so much that Obama has a base problem or Obama has a, you know, insert name of the group here problem. You know, Obama has an economy problem. And when the economy is as awful as it is and the prospects are as bleak as they are right now, your approval ratings as a president are going to fall. And they're going to fall at dangerously low levels, and they're going to fall among every group. And you're going to be in the position he's now in, which is a very, very iffy bet for reelection. And if he is able to pull it out, it may end up being more because the other side loses it, because the Republicans somehow, maybe by nominating an unacceptable or too extreme-seeming candidate, blow an election that they otherwise should have won.
Well, I'm going to pick up on that after this very short break. Steve Carnegie, we're going to try to get you on a better phone line. Robert Costa, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Christiana Care Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, Christiana Care cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. Christiana Care, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
Celebrate one of America's greatest composers, George Gershwin. We'll hear from those who study and perform his works for stage, screen, and concert hall. Plus versions of Gershwin's work from Doc Watson, Nina Simone, Miles Davis, and others. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Sunday night at 6 on WHYY.
Folkways at Gwynedd supports WHYY. Guided by time-honored Quaker values, Folkways is a continuing care retirement community for adults 65 and over. Since 1967, Folkways has been providing its residents with a comprehensive health program and financial stability. Folkways is committed to friendship, caring, and respect as a way of life. For more information or a personal tour, the number is 215-283-7010.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Steve Carnacki, political editor for Salon. We hope he's on a better phone line. Robert Costa, the National Review's political reporter, and we're doing a roundup of the week's worth of political news and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Robert, let me go back to you and actually talk about the Republicans who are running to be the nominee for president, and even going back to Monday evening's CNN Tea Party debate. It looks as if Rick Perry, at least for the moment, is leading the pack. Does that causing some kind of angst for mainstream Republicans, especially the ones that are leaders deep within the party?
Oh, yes, I definitely think so. I just had lunch yesterday with Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a well-known maverick in the U.S. Senate, Republican, and he expressed some concerns about Rick Perry's statements on foreign policy during the CNN debate. Perry made some noise about perhaps withdrawing troops from Afghanistan quite speedily, and he agreed with John Huntsman, the more moderate guy, on that issue. And he's also made comments about Social Security, calling it a Ponzi scheme, and that has raised some eyebrows within the GOP, and also his policy in Texas about vaccines for young girls and preventing them from getting cervical cancer has caused some concern. And Perry is a very charismatic figure. I was with him in Richmond a couple days ago as he campaigned with Governor Bob McDonnell down there. And Perry is a well-liked figure. He has a great jobs record. But his initial entry into the race, his stumbles on certain things and explaining his record and a few choice quotes, has some concern. But no one's too worried about him at the moment. But there's some chatter about that.
And Steve, why do you think Mitt Romney, who seems like he's been campaigning for years now, has not been able to sort of grab this GOP leadership?
Well, first, I hope the phone signal's a little better.
You do sound a little bit better.
If it's bad, I think Romney is actually in a fairly decent position right now. If you sort of start with the proposition that he was never really going to run away with this thing, to begin with, he always was sort of a flawed candidate from the perspective of the Republican Party base. Because of his moderate record in Massachusetts, they never really fully trusted him. And you look at the mood of the party today, the sort of Tea Party era that the Republican Party is in. So Mitt Romney was never going to just walk away with this thing. So when you look at that, you say, well, he's only a few points behind Rick Perry in the polls right now. The whole healthcare situation in Massachusetts, where he passed what basically became the model for Obamacare in Massachusetts, that hasn't taken the toll on him right now that people were predicting it would 6 months or a year ago. And I think we started to see this week that there are some sort of chinks in Perry's armor. And, Robert alluded to them there, but, when you look at the Republican Party, the promise of Rick Perry was that he would emerge sort of as the true, pure conservative candidate. All of those voters and all those activists who were skeptical about Mitt Romney would find a safe and comfortable home with Rick Perry. And it certainly has started out looking that way, but when you look at the debate this week and you saw, well, he's got some vulnerabilities with the party base on immigration. He's got vulnerabilities with the party base on this whole vaccine issue down in Texas. And then, of course, there's the foreign policy and Afghanistan aspect to it. So I think if it ends up being a situation where the base, has some issues with Perry and they have some issues with Mitt Romney, then maybe they start thinking more about electability and who we really want up there on that stage with Barack Obama next year. And I talked about this in the last segment, that whole issue of, Obama is ripe to be defeated in 2012 if you're a Republican. He doesn't have to lose. If you nominate the wrong candidate, he might just survive. And I think if that's the calculation that drives the Republicans, and I think it may end up being that way, Romney can win.
And Robert Costa, there have been over the last couple of weeks and even before that some investigations into Texas. The state, yes, has created jobs, but it has the highest percentage of minimum wage workers in the country. They're going to have to deal with some budget cuts, which could affect the employment rate in that state. NPR did a piece yesterday about some of his supporters and some of the quote-unquote deals that they may have gotten in Texas. Do you think he's vulnerable? The more the press begins to investigate what he's been doing as governor of Texas?
Yes and no. I think the point you just made could make him vulnerable in a general election against President Obama. But in a GOP primary, you're not seeing those concerns, those specific concerns about how he spins his job record, et cetera, bubbling up as real issues. But you do see in the last debate that Perry's crony capitalism has been criticized by Michelle Bachmann. It's been alluded to in criticism by Sarah Palin, two Tea Party favorites. And there's a real sense that Perry may have too close ties to business interests. His political record, legislative record, is too closely aligned with that. It hasn't been fleshed out too much in the primary yet, but it could. The real problem for Mitt Romney is enthusiasm. Since Rick Perry has got into the race, think about this. There have been 12 national polls about the GOP primary. In all 12 polls, Rick Perry leads. The last time Mitt Romney has led in a national poll was in early August, August 7th. And Mitt Romney, when in the last debate, it was almost like a prosecutor going after Perry, taking him on those issues that you mentioned, questioning his record. He even made fun of Perry's job record, saying, well, Perry was dealt four aces with the favorable economic climate down there. But it doesn't seem like it's catching on for Romney. And I think Perry has made Romney a stronger candidate in many ways, in the sense that it's making Romney sharper, making him pick up his game after being a long-time front-runner for months and months. But Romney, I'm not sure, has found a way to get at Perry yet. And I'm not so sure those stories about Perry's record in Texas will work. But maybe it's Perry's own stumbles that will be his falling, should he fall.
Well, Stephen, I never thought I'd be talking about a cancer vaccine in a presidential race, but that came up at the GOP presidential debate on Monday. Michelle Bachmann then went on to say that a woman had come up to her at an event saying that this vaccine caused mental retardation of her daughter. Some ethicists have been calling her out. Her own former campaign advisor, Ed Rollins, said she was wrong. Has she really boxed herself into a corner?
You know, she hurt herself, and it's interesting how this has all played out, because she was, I think, the biggest victim immediately of Rick Perry getting into the presidential race was actually Michelle Bachmann. I mean, it seems like a long time ago now, but she was really the sensation on the Republican side in the spring and summer months. You know, in that same weekend in late August that Rick Perry got into the presidential race, she actually won that straw poll out in Iowa. And that was supposed to be sort of her big, you know, moment where she really announced her arrival. And instead, she basically disappeared for a few weeks after that. And heading into that debate on Monday, you know, there was talk that she was, you know, she'd basically become irrelevant on the Republican side. But it was in that debate with that issue of the HPV vaccine down in Texas, she really seemed to wake up, and she really seemed to find a role in the Republican race. And it was giving voice to these, I guess it's, you know, more Christian conservatives, social conservatives, who really have an issue with the idea of Rick Perry or anybody mandating that kind of vaccine for teenage girls. And she really went after him hard and aggressively on that. It's not an issue that Mitt Romney is going to go after Rick Perry on that aggressively. So there really was an opening there for somebody on the Republican side to do it, and it was Bachmann. And I think she really, you know, initially at least got some traction from that. But then going that extra step and talking about somebody saying that it had caused mental retardation and basically going to war now with the entire, you know, medical establishment that would say that's just not true, it reinforces all the doubts, I think, that sort of existed about Bachmann before, and that is she's just too erratic. She's just too prone to say things that they're going to get her in trouble, and it may have eaten into the momentum she got from the debate. But I do think she's interesting to watch, because there could be a tag team here where Mitt Romney kind of goes after Rick Perry on more of the electability questions and saying his Social Security rhetoric or something like that is too extreme. And then Bachmann goes after him on more of the sort of red meat social conservative issues. And the combination of that, I think, could wear Perry down a little bit.
Interesting. That's Steve Kornacki, political editor for Salon. Also with us is Robert Costa. He's the National Review's political reporter, and both of them joining us today on Radio Times as we shoehorn a lot of political news into our discussion. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. As you look at this political race, such as it is, what strikes you, who interests you, do give us a call. Robert, let me go back to to you, and this has been talked about all week, but I think I'd be curious what both of you have to say. And this is the audience in the debate on Monday when a question came up about health care and an example given that if, you know, someone dies because they don't have health care, there was a yeah and some applause from the audience. At a previous debate when Rick Perry talked about or was asked about the number of executions in Texas, there was a huge round of applause for that. What does that tell us about the Tea Party or perhaps the base of the Republican Party?
When you look at the applause, first for the death penalty, I could understand why some viewers thought that was crass. But I do think that in the most recent debate, when you had some quite scattered applause for Ron Paul's statements about whether the government should step in and take care of someone without insurance, is not so indicative of where the Tea Party stands or the Republican Party stands. One, just because there weren't many applause lines. But I think Wolf Blitzer, who was the moderator of that debate, and asking a question about whether the government should step in and take care of someone if they're sick, should they not have insurance, it was a little bit, you have to listen to how Wolf Blitzer worded that question. He talked about society, quote, society. And I think what a lot of conservatives were cheering was not the idea that a sick person wouldn't be taken care of, but that government should step out of the business of providing insurance and providing health care, and society and private organizations and companies, they should be the ones providing health care. And I know that when you hear these this chatter about the applause and Republicans cheering on death, or whether it be the death penalty or someone without insurance, it's easy to say, oh, look at those Tea Party types. They're not sympathetic to people who are hurting. But I think that's a little bit unfair and just skims the surface. I think there's a real argument, right versus left, on what the government should do, what private organizations and society should do. And Ron Paul was just making the point in his answer that the government shouldn't always play the role of taking care of people. But he also made the point that in every emergency room in the country, he is a physician himself. You always take care of those who come in. It's a question of the government's role. It's not an argument about human life.
But Steve Kornacki, it seems that at the base of that question was who pays if someone either can't afford health insurance, and that's probably many more people than those who choose not to have it, who pays when they go to the hospital or the emergency room to get care?
Yeah, and I think this gets to a sort of a bigger issue and a bigger potential problem that the Republican Party has. There's something, I think, to what Robert's saying, in that maybe too much was made of the crowd's reaction Monday night, in that when Wolf Blitzer talked about the hypothetical death of the 30-year-old, there really was only one person who actually said something. But I think the question, or who sort of shouted out, but I think the question that raises is, why then the reaction of this is generated? And I think the answer there is it feeds into a broader sort of image problem, perception problem that the Republican Party has in the Tea Party era, and that is that it's a party that's been sort of overrun by people who are sort of ideological extremists. If you look at the polling data, you know, for the past year or so, for the past 9 months since the Republicans won the 2010 midterms, the image of the Republican Party has fallen steadily to the lowest level in the history of modern polling. The favorable image of the Republican Party in a poll conducted a few weeks ago had fallen to 33%. They have not, as a party, been in this territory since they impeached Bill Clinton in 1998, you know, back when Bill Clinton was a very popular president and nobody really thought they should be doing that. And so when you have stories like this, where, you know, you're at a Republican debate and the crowd erupts in cheers at the mention of a governor imposing the death penalty, you know, hundreds of times, or you have a Republican debate and there's somebody in the audience who seems, you know, giddy at the idea that an uninsured 30-year-old died, I think it really feeds into that perception that this is a party that is too ideologically extreme in this era. And when I talked earlier about the Republicans losing a winnable election in 2012, that's the risk. The risk for them is that the economy is bad, President Obama's approval ratings are not good, and voters want to get rid of him as president because of it. Then they look at the Republican side and they say, we just don't want to go that far.
Well, what's interesting, Robert, because this is sort of about what a mandate would do to a health insurance system, a mandate obviously requiring people to get health insurance. That was a Republican idea that goes back to, what, the 1990s?
Yeah, that is true, and many Republicans have supported the mandate over the years. But to Steve's point about feeding the perception about extremism, I think that's valid. I think it does feed that perception in certain circles. But I think with the applause about the death penalty, what conservatives were really cheering was justice. And I think even whether they – probably because they agree with the death penalty, some conservatives do not. And two, with the health care question, they were cheering personal responsibility. Now, does it feed a perception? Is it a Rorschach test? Can you interpret it many ways? Of course. But I think what it proves more than anything is that Tea Party conservatives and are excitable, not that they're necessarily extremists. And on the point about the mandate, yes, I think President Obama, if Mitt Romney is the nominee, can make that argument. He can say that Republicans have supported this. Maybe even Mitt Romney was an inspiration for my health care program. But at the end of the day, I really believe that the 2012 cycle is not going to be about nitpicking about what Republicans supported in 1995 or 1997 or about whether a few Tea Party people cheer and it gets a lot of buzz on the blogs. It's going to be about the economy. It's going to be a little bit about foreign policy, but mostly jobs. And we can always dance around the edges, but Republicans have a real argument against Obama and the economy, and as much as there may be concerns about this or that, I think that's the real theme next year.
Well, let me pick up on that and throw that to you, Steve Kornacki, and clearly the Republicans do have a different position from the president on the economy and on this jobs plan that he has been touting around the country. Is it a philosophical difference, you think, or do they just want to make sure that the president fails?
I think there's a little of both, because you can look at some of the proposals that Obama's put forward, both in this package and that he's been pushing for a while now, and that same thing you're talking about with the mandate rears its head again, and that is that it's a policy that sort of Republicans used to back. And then I would talk specifically about the payroll tax cut. That's a policy that Republicans have supported in the past, and it's hard to see why they would oppose it now, but Obama has been out there, even before he introduced this particular jobs package, he's been out there saying, you know, we need to extend the payroll tax cuts that we enacted last December, and Republicans have been balking. And it's hard for me to look at that and see that that's really an ideological or philosophical thing as much as it is a strategic thing. It's a tax cut that might boost the economy a little bit and that Obama would get credit for. And therefore they don't want any part of it. So I think there is a strategic angle to all of this, and that's why this jobs bill is so interesting for me to watch, because if you just look at it in sort of raw Machiavellian terms, a bad economy helps the Republicans in 2012. There's no question about that. If this jobs package goes absolutely nowhere and nothing else is enacted in the next year or the next few months, really, the economy will definitely be in a very bad place in 2012, and it will work to the Republicans' advantage. But the other factor that they have to kind of consider, I think, is how much blame are they going to get? If it is seen as Obama has now introduced a plan, Democrats have unified behind it, it's an open question whether they will, but if right. all the Democrats really unify behind this, it's the Republicans who are seen as the only reason we didn't get a job package through, it would have changed the economy. That help Obama, and I think there's something for Republicans to think about there.
And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation talking about the week's worth of politics with Steve Kornacki and Robert Costa. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Reading Terminal Market supports WHYY. Reading Terminal Market at 12th and Arch Streets has been a Center City landmark for over 100 years. The market's 80 local merchants offer farm-fresh meat, seafood, and poultry, plus produce, baked goods, Pennsylvania Dutch foods, and dozens of eating options from Philly favorites to a wide range of ethnic specialties. Parking is available at the Parkway Garage at 12th and Filbert Streets. Information online at readingterminalmarket.org. Reading Terminal Market, fresh and local every day.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A lawyer who's defended detainees at Guantanamo fears it will never close. Also, the local food movement comes to a hardscrabble Vermont town. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art supports WHYY, presenting Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus, the first exhibition in Philadelphia ever to include the rare painting, prints, and portraits of Rembrandt, the great painter of the Dutch Golden Age. Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus reassembles a group of more than 50 intimate portraits of Christ that have not been seen together since they left the artist's home in Amsterdam more than 350 years ago, on view through October 30th only. More information at philamuseum.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. On Monday, GOP presidential contenders squared off at a debate hosted by CNN and the Tea Party. Later in the week, a Republican won the congressional seat vacated by Democrat Anthony Weiner. President Obama has been out stumping for his jobs program while House Speaker John Boehner criticized the bill and other programs and ideas coming from the president. Talking about all of this and more with Robert Costa, the National Review's political reporter, and Steve Kornacki, political editor for Salon, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Ronald from King of Prussia to join our conversation. And Ronald, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I identify Republican, although I'm not a party line Republican. I strongly disagree with both your guest comments about the reaction when they said, when they spoke about the death penalty, when they spoke about, let the man die. I was aghast, and no one in the audience censored that. No one booed. No one disapproved. I myself stood, I sat there and was, interested in what was being said. That threw me for a loop. I think it's an ugliness that does not represent our party, and I personally have no use for it.
Well, Ronald, I appreciate the call. And actually, Robert Costa, let me get a response from you. Go ahead.
Hey, Ronald, I think that's a very valid point. And I think you're bringing up an important lesson for Republicans as this presidential campaign unfolds, is that the optics do matter. Now, I would argue against your point that this is a small room. I would not call it a microcosm. It wasn't scientific about what conservatives or the Tea Party or Republicans are thinking. But you're right. Republicans are in this media age where everything can be picked up on and become a national narrative, even if it's just a small room or even two people yelling out at a presidential debate. Republicans have to be careful because there is a sense, as Steve keeps pointing out, that on the left, for President Obama to win with such a bad economy, you have to paint conservatives as a little bit wacky, as a little bit extreme and out there. And these debates, even though I wouldn't say they teach us anything about the conservatives, they do make Republicans, even as Ronald said, aghast. I think Republicans have to keep making a policy argument and make sure that that is the lead against President Obama next year, and it doesn't become the Tea Party color, as fun as that can be sometimes, because that really is not the story about what the Tea Party is about or what the conservatives are pushing for next year. And Ronald has a fair point. Republicans don't like those kind of reactions. You heard a lot of shaking heads and mutterings about why are these people even saying this at a debate? Can't they just keep shushed? And I think that's something Republicans have to be concerned about, because as much as they think they're making a big case against Obama, it's the little things sometimes, the yelpers at a Tea Party rally, that the left can hang on to and say, and point a finger and say, that's the right, and that's the choice.
Ronald, thanks for the call. Let me get Lonnie from, looks like Berwyn, to join us on Radio Times. Lonnie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
My point is that we've had the Bush tax cuts now for 10 years. It's not Obama's economy. He inherited it. The problem is that nobody's been making the point about this. And so, Mr. Boehner, where are the jobs? They've had 2 years now in Congress. They're doing everything to thwart our economy. And, this whole thing with the tax cuts, and that, and the Republicans are so good at staying on message. Obama forgot to take negotiating 101 when he was in law school, and he should stop giving away the store before he negotiates hard to get what he was elected to bring to this country, and it's really just so sad.
Well, Lonnie, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Steve Kornacki, let me toss that to you. And this is a complaint you hear from Democrats and liberals that the president isn't tough enough. Do you think there's some truth there?
Basically, no. Let's take the Bush tax cuts question. Bush tax cuts were extended in December of 2010. This was several weeks after a midterm election in which the Democratic Party lost more than 60 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives and suffered one of the worst midterm landslides that we've ever seen in this country. Yes, the Democrats technically, had majority in both chambers still because it was a lame duck session in December, but politically they were coming off of a terrible election, so I don't think they were in position at that point to insist on it's our way or the highway on the Bush tax cuts. What Obama was able to do, though, you talk about negotiating, was in exchange for extending the Bush tax cuts only through the 2012 elections, Obama was able to get what amounted to a second, albeit much smaller, stimulus package. He was able to get Republicans to agree on spending more money to help the economy. And one of the areas that Obama got them to bend was on cutting the payroll tax, which is money that goes directly to workers. That is something that's geared toward the middle class, toward the working class. That's not about rich people. That's not about corporations. And that's something that Republicans are now saying they don't want. Well, that tax was cut in December because Barack Obama cut a deal with Republicans in the Bush tax cuts. He cut that deal a month after his party was absolutely wiped out in the midterm elections. If you want to make the point that he should have been absolute on the Bush tax cuts and let them expire and that would be that, then fine. But you also wouldn't have got the payroll tax cut. You also wouldn't have gotten some of the stimulus measures that came through in December. And that's a result, I think, of what was probably smart negotiating.
Well, Steve, and this is getting a little bit into the weeds, but I'm just curious, though, whether... You explained what happened in the lame duck session at the end of December. Do you think the public knows about that? And I ask that wondering whether people, the public, voters, and maybe the president don't communicate. Let me put it in a better way, that the president seems to be unable to kind of sell his what he has done to the public.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to that. Although, if you look back at the polling, what's interesting is when the deal was cut to extend the Bush tax cuts, the polling on that in December was actually very good, and that went across the board. A majority of Democrats, a clear majority of Democrats, said they actually liked the deal. That was actually one of the more popular sort of major initiatives that Obama was able to pass. So it's something that there are critics on the left who look back at it now. Oh my God! Obama shouldn't have caved. He never should have passed. Never should have extended the Bush tax cuts. But when he did, it was actually a very popular move. It was much more popular than the deal he ultimately cut on the debt ceiling. I think the bigger issue here is we can talk about his struggles as a communicator, and I can. There are criticisms that I would certainly level at him. I wouldn't let him off the hook entirely. But I think when we talk about politicians and presidents in particular having communications problems, they're almost always entirely a function of the political climate, the economic climate. And when times are bad, politicians seem to magically lose their ability to communicate. When times are good, they seem to get it. And I think of Ronald Reagan. When Ronald Reagan, the great communicator, was president, and the unemployment rate was 10%, his approval rating fell to 35%. He wasn't the great communicator anymore. But then the economy came back, and Reagan's ability to communicate came back. And I think if this economy were to turn around, probably say the same thing about Obama.
Lonnie, thanks for the call to Radio Time. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Jennifer from Swarthmore to join us. And Jennifer, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm just calling in to respectfully disagree with your guest comment earlier that the Tea Party just is sort of an excitable group, and they're not necessarily extremist or... that's what your guests seem to imply. I mean, a year ago, the town hall meetings and the very strong reaction against the health care plan was just insane. And accusations of Obama being socialist, Muslim, not American. I mean, there was a constant drumbeat of it. And I don't feel like the more moderate Republicans came out and explicitly denounced that. I mean, maybe there were a few instances of it, but I couldn't even cite them. What? So, I think the Republicans are really just, trying to benefit from this, these sort of comments, and another drumbeat is starting up that 50% of Americans don't pay taxes, and we should go after them. And
well, Jennifer, and, let me take your points, and they're good ones, and I'm going to toss that to you, Robert Costa.
I think that your point about so-called moderate Republicans speaking up about the Tea Party, your point about the Muslim and President Obama, I think many, many Republicans have spoken up and denounced any kind of talk like that. And your point about calling the president a socialist, certainly Republican politicians have alluded to that, and more just talking about his liberal-style politics. I don't think they're alluding to his being a dictator or anything like that. But you're right, it comes back to my original point that sometimes people hear different things with certain words. So some conservatives hear socialism and they nod their head about a big government liberal, but others hear socialism and they think they're demeaning the office of the presidency. And then there are valid arguments on both sides there. But I think when we look to 2012, more important than any of this discussion about what the Tea Party means is if you listen to the politics this week in Washington, it's not about defining the Tea Party, it's about defining the economy. And President Obama, with his speech to Congress, came with a bill and said, pass this bill, and you see Republicans at the same time digging in. John Boehner gave a speech that was very much centered on regulation. The president's speech to Congress was very much centered on stimulus and growing new programs and infrastructure. And so these are the competing arguments. It's not about extremists versus perhaps a more vanilla Democrat alternative. It's about regulation, cutting taxes on the right, and then growing the economy from the inside via federal government spending on the left. And I really believe we can have every debate about the Tea Party, and I understand if you are concerned about some of the Tea Party rhetoric. Some people in the Republican Party and the Tea Party movement, they disagree with certain things that are said in the Tea Party. That's part of the beauty and the curse of the Tea Party. It's a wonderful organization that emphasizes many conservative values on fiscal issues and on certain social issues, but it's amorphous, and it doesn't have a head, and it's hard to point a finger and say this or that's the Tea Party. Is it someone yelling at a debate? Or is it a certain Tea Party leader? It's hard to say. But the Republican Party is an official organization. They are making a case for elections next year. And if you look at what they're saying, always listen to what they're saying rather than what some outsider is saying as a Tea Party spokesman. That's what's important, and it's about jobs, it's about the economy, and the deferring arguments there.
Steve, I know you're not an economist, but this super committee is charged with coming up with something like $1.2 or $1.5 trillion worth of cuts in federal spending over the next decade. There's now some pressure to come up with $4 trillion worth of cuts. Is it possible to create jobs and cut government spending to that level?
Like you said, I'm not an economist, but I took a few economics classes in college, and certainly my understanding of that is no. But my other understanding of what some of the Democrats are pushing for on the super committee is to backload a lot of the you put that number out there, however many trillion it's going to end up being, is to backload a lot of the cuts and to put them several years, many years down the line, so that you can Washington's good with that kind of math, where you can tout a big number in terms of cuts, and the actual effect isn't felt until maybe years down the line. So I think there's going to be some of that involved with the super committee. But I think if you accept the basic sort of Keynesian proposition that when you have a sort of demand side problem in the economy like we seem to right now, mm-hmm. That really only the government is positioned to pour the kind of money into it that's needed to sort of jumpstart it. If you accept that proposition, then we need more stimulus in the next few months for voters in November 2012 to feel any kind of confidence the economy is coming back. And I think the bigger dynamic there is you look at that super committee, you look at the Tea Party, you look at the Republicans who control Congress, and I don't see a single Republican vote for any kind of real stimulus. And I don't see how Obama's able to get around that and how the Democrats are able to get around that. And you look at his jobs proposal, and what it really comes down to is it ends up being more about politics than economics, because if the Republicans aren't going to sign off on any kind of stimulus, then the best thing that Obama can hope for is to convince the country that he's got a plan that's actually going to help the economy, that the only reason it's not in place is because of the Republicans, and to use it as a political weapon. That may end up being the only value of this.
And we're almost out of time here. We had a caller from Drexel Hill, and I'm sorry we can't get Jeff on. He wanted to talk about poverty in America, which, of course, is a big and important topic. Let me toss this to you, Robert Costa. Do you think the mood, the time is right for a third-party candidate, which, of course, we know from the past has been tried. There hasn't been one in a while, but is the atmosphere right for that?
Oh, I think very much so, especially if Rick Perry is the nominee. The governor of Texas is very popular with conservatives, but there's already buzz in political circles that if Rick Perry is the nominee, you have someone who's considered very much a conservative, hard right, and then if President Obama is considered to be a liberal. And there's going to be room in the center of the political space for someone to jump in. Would it be a Michael Bloomberg of New York? Could it be someone who's more of an outsider from the right, like Sarah Palin, to even spoil it more? But I think you may see someone like a John Huntsman, though he's running for the Republican nomination right now, a John Huntsman, a Michael Bloomberg, someone who's more moderate, a little bit to the right, who could make the argument against Obama while simultaneously saying that the Republican nominee, should it be the Texas governor or someone else like Michelle Bachmann, is a bit too far to the right, and you could make an argument in that center political space. I don't think we're going to have someone like Ross Perot, a business leader, run maybe from the center as much, someone from the outside, mainly because I don't see anyone rising, but also that Republicans are making such a strong fiscal case that it's going to be someone who's more talking about Steve's points and some of the callers' points. They don't like the temper or the tone of the Republican nominee, and they're dissatisfied with President Obama. And so that's going to be a fun thing for everyone to watch, whether someone from the center and independent jumps in.
Well, on that note, we have to say goodbye. Robert Costa, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
He's political reporter for the National Review. Steve Kornacki, thank you for joining us as well. And he's, we just lost that phone line, a political editor for Salon. I'm Marty Mosco, and go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, podcasts, and the archive.